Deutsche Welle. Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome to Inside Europe. In Bonn, I'm Neil King. On today's programme, as Greenland's first female Prime Minister is sworn in, we take a closer look at her political agenda. Why cash-strapped Greece can't afford to reduce military spending any further, and we take you to a special service of London's first atheist church.
For me, I went to church till I was 17 and then I stopped believing in God. And the thing I missed wasn't God, but church. So for me, it was how can you have that experience without? So it's quite nice that you can have like-minded people. And we don't really ask people what they believe here, you know. You can come whatever you think.
That story and more coming up on the programme. First to Greenland, which is swearing in its first female Prime Minister this week. Her name is Aleqa Hammond, a 47-year-old Inuit whose centrist Sumyut party took 42% of the vote last month after vowing to tax foreign mining companies. The exploitation of Greenland's vast mineral reserves were a key election issue, especially so-called rare earth metals, which are crucial for manufacturing high-tech products such as smartphones. Hammond and her party have also been campaigning for Greenlandic independence. Although the Arctic island has a large degree of autonomy, the former colonial master Denmark is still pulling the strings when it comes to foreign affairs, defence and monetary policy. Earlier, I spoke to our correspondent Alex Rosenzweig, who interviewed Hammond after her surprise victory last month. I started by asking him whether the new premier will make good on her independence pledge.
Yes, Neil, in the long term for sure. And she's also taken in her coalition a new nationalist party, Parti Inuit, whose leader refused to debate in Danish during the campaign. And he also wants to ban the use of Danish language in the parliament. Aleqa Hammond is now 47 and she wants to see Greenland independent, though she knows it will be a question of money above all, because the Greenlandic economy is still very much dependent on Danish subsidies.
I think already independent. I think as a strong nation. And I see Greenland being independent. And to achieve the economical independence from Denmark, it puts us into a delicate situation, but also opens up new opportunities to achieve that. That's why we think it's so important that our legislation regarding minerals is our key way out of economic independence from Denmark. It will be independent someday where I still am alive. I want to be there the day where we raise our flag and we sing and there will be a worldwide declaration saying that today Greenland is a nation.
Okay, so quite a national outlook there. To this day, Alex, Greenland remains the only nation to have left the European community. Are there any regrets over this? Would Greenland, for instance, like to rejoin the EU, do you think?
No, Neil, no regrets at all, so far at least. And for all the people I could meet, Greenland got out in 1985 because of fishing policies. And still today, there are serious disagreements, for instance, about seal skins or whales. And almost 30 years after, as the new head of the government puts it, it seems the divorce between Greenland and the European Union has been a happy one.
If you look at me, I don't look like a European person. And I don't think like a European person. And geographically, we are not in Europe. I have three reasons why we should not be part of the European Union. But I think at the same time, when I've said that, Greenland can and has a very good cooperation with the European Union. European Union needs Greenland. Greenland needs European Union. But we don't have to be members. We can be partners in cooperation. And that's what I think is very important. As a former colony under European Union country, we have a status under that, and that has given us access to programs under European Union to the benefit of European Union, but also to the benefit of us. That's why we have made a cooperation. We give European Union quotas on fisheries, whereas we get money back from European Union. And this cooperation has been very healthy and has been also shown mutual respect in all cases. And we are actually expanding the cooperation. And I think it's good. And we should maintain it this way.
Okay, Alex, now we've talked about Aleja's political agenda and her plans for the country, also regarding the European Union. Now, you've met her. Perhaps we could end this interview on a more personal note. Can you describe what she's like as a person? How did she come across to you in the interview?
A strong and proud woman, I would say, Neil. She's the first woman in history to be the Greenlandic Prime Minister, and she was keen to tell me her story, her tough childhood in a northern village. Her father, an Inuit hunter and fisherman, fell through the ice and died when she was only 7. So some critics say she is a populist, but as a matter of fact, she easily connects with the communities of remote areas, and she's one of them, so to say. But on the other hand, she traveled the world and speaks several languages. You could hear how she speaks well English. She's been trained by media advisors to cope with the international press. And with Greenland now being a key player in the Arctic, I think Aleja Hammond is going to be a very busy woman in the next 4 years, at least, with a lot of important decisions to make for Greenland's future.
That's Alex Rosenzweig filling us in on Greenland's new premier, Aleja Hammond. Thank you very much for your time, Alex.
Thank you.
For more information, go to our webpage, dw.de.
Now let's turn to Spain, whose ailing economy could well do with some of Greenland's lucrative minerals. With one of the highest unemployment rates in Europe, 26%, the government is scrambling to save money wherever it can. As part of the austerity measures, Madrid has even cut holiday bonuses for all civil servants. But Spanish public workers are still the envy of their countrymen. They make more money than their private sector counterparts and enjoy much more job security. Lauren Freyer reports from Madrid on how Spain's best and brightest young graduates nearly all want to work for the government.
Antonio, Domingo and Pepe are old friends in their late 40s and 50s. They're all unemployed, so most mornings they meet for coffee and cigarettes in Madrid's Puerta del Sol Square and rant about the government.
Porque está cobrando más de la cuenta. Esos son los que les tenían que recortar. Gana mucho y no hace nada.
They earn much more than they're worth. That's something that's got to change. They earn a lot and they hardly do anything.
The men grumble about what they imagine is the life of a government worker. Long coffee breaks, siesta, and lots of paid time off. When Spain's economic crisis hit, the private sector immediately started shedding jobs and cutting wages. New labor reforms have made it even easier for companies to do so, and unemployment now tops 26%. But most public employees still have jobs for life, says economist Gail Allard at Madrid's IE Business School.
They have had their wages frozen. Hiring has been frozen, but it's not the kind of severe adjustment you're seeing in the private sector. And you hear people say, wait a minute, in my company, you know, we've cut all of our costs 30%. What's their problem? You know, we're doing this. Why can't they do it?
One reason is their strong union contracts. Another is the sheer number of civil servants in Spain. Bureaucrats, doctors, teachers, and all public workers amount to 2.6 million people, more than 11% of the population, which makes politicians think twice about crossing them. Spaniards also have a different attitude toward the state. The Pew Research Center recently found that while 6 in 10 Americans say they want to be free of interference from the state, more than 6 in 10 Spaniards say the opposite, that it's the government's job to make sure nobody is in need. Again, Gail Allard.
It's a funny thing. I think Americans, we have a hard time understanding it because we don't assign such a high value to security. But for Spaniards, that's really, really important is security.
Spaniards stay on waiting lists for years in hopes of snagging a public sector job. And it's not just for the security. Civil servants earned 30% more on average than the rest of Spain's workers last year. That wasn't always the case. Sitting in a cafe near his Madrid home, 80-year-old Tomás García Boado, a retired public administrator, describes living through the Spanish Civil War and the military dictatorship that followed.
Y sí, era la época del racionamiento. Esto lo recuerdo incluso en casa, porque te estaba racionado.
We used to have to ration food. Under the dictatorship, being a civil servant was prestigious, even if you weren't well paid. It gave you guarantees that you'd be taken care of and have security for the future.
Memories like these shape the next generation's choices. Lorena Nieva worked in marketing in Madrid for almost a decade before moving back in with her parents and devoting her early 30s to studying for a government entrance exam.
And I stayed studying for it probably 4 or 5 years of my life. Some of them working for some private companies, but my decision and my illusion was to get that job. I couldn't get it because of the crisis.
With a degree in political science and experience in business, Nieva would have been a shoo-in for government work 5 years ago. But with the crisis, only a handful of the thousands who took the entrance exam last year got jobs. So Nieva is back in the private sector in a temp job at a phone company. At 36, she's making less money than ever in her life, like many in her generation.
We are really worried, and we don't have any door open for us. Although the politician says constantly we can go abroad.
Sadly, for the next few years at least, going abroad may be her best option. Lauren Freyer, DW, Madrid.
And we stay in the Mediterranean. Now, Greece has for the past weeks dropped off the Eurozone crisis radar a bit, thanks to Cyprus's financial meltdown. But Athens' woes are far from over, and austerity remains the overriding principle. Now, while many Greeks are prepared to do their bit to stay in the Eurozone, some feel that certain sectors are being let off too lightly. The military, for instance. In terms of GDP, Greece still has the second largest defence budget in NATO. However, as Anthi Karasava found out in Athens, there are plenty of army officers who fear any further cuts to defence spending would not only undermine the army's morale, but also its ability to defend the country against Greece's old arch rival.
Sipping tea and coffee at an officers' club in central Athens, retired generals and admirals reminisce about what they call the glorious past. They talk of the fierce armed forces which they once commanded, the endless resources they had to work with, the threat which the country continues to face, Turkey. Now they warn, 3 years into the worst financial crisis in decades, austerity is crushing Greece's defense capabilities. Just recently, says Yorgos Glitzis, a retired submarine officer, a Turkish battleship strayed twice into Greek waters. And what did we do? We chased it halfway through the Aegean with a ship half its size, a plastic dinghy. The incident in the Aegean was the latest in a series of regular run-ins and provocations between Greece and Turkey, two age-old foes that came to the brink of war nearly 20 years ago. Ironically, lingering tension has long served like a tonic for both countries' militaries, with each side regularly testing the other's combat readiness along a dividing, oil-rich sea each claimed to have exclusive rights to. But now Greece's recession-ravaged economy is complicating matters. Biting budget cuts are strangling the nation's defense capabilities, sapping military morale and feeding far-right nationalism, even murmurs of a military rebellion, pundits, politicians and defense experts warn. Lieutenant Commander Theodore Boukouvalis explains.
Austerity has amputated our military. Any additional cuts would be like stripping Oscar Pistorius of his prosthetics.
Indeed, since the government here took a first sledgehammer to the defense budget in 2010, defense experts, politicians and officers say the military's operational costs have been chopped by 29%, creating problems. With a budget crunch taking a 30% swipe in the salaries of military personnel, Greece is now facing shortage in the most valuable military resource, morale. Yanis Katsaroulis, a retired Navy supply officer, is irate.
How they expect the country to defend itself against hostile, unreliable Turks? The military isn't just bleeding because of the cuts, it's boiling.
And yet, despite deep defense cuts, Greece continues to spend the largest amount in defense in the European Union, allocating 2.1% or else $7.5 billion of its national economic output to the military in 2011, when European NATO members, by contrast, spent under 1.6%. By some accounts, if Greece had dropped defense spending to those levels over the last 20 years, then Greeks could have been spared billions in grueling austerity now. Ruling lawmakers also don't want to look compromising either to Turkey or their biggest domestic political threat, Golden Dawn, a far-right party whose signature mix of militaristic rhetoric and thuggish practices has prospered enormously during the crisis here. Back at the officer's club in central Athens, Yannis Katsaroulis, a Navy supply officer, explains.
We recently met with the defense minister to voice our anger about the cuts, and one of us, a brigadier, piped up and said that we're all dead set on voting for Golden Dawn in the next elections. I added, saying, don't be surprised if tanks roll out onto the streets and a military rebellion occurs. Everything is possible at this point.
Greek military experts rule out any likelihood of a return to military rule here. But so long as politicians here fail to take it on and reform it, that likelihood will continue to fester. Anthi Karasava, DW Athens.
And I'm Neil King in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. Now, Easter has just finished, but if you're an atheist, you probably wouldn't care about that anyway, which is exactly why London's first atheist church, or Sunday Assembly, is running their Easter for Atheists service on the 7th of April. The Assembly was the brainchild of two stand-up comics, Pippa Evans and Saunderson Jones, who by their own admission wanted to create a church without the God bit. Emma Wallace went along to their service in March in North London.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are gathered here today to sing the Beatles, Live Better, Help Often, and Wonder More. It's not hymns, but the Beatles' Help, Bonnie Tyler's Holding Out for a Hero, and Bill Withers' Lean on Me that form the order of service at London's first atheist church. No, this is not a cult, at least I hope it's not, but a gathering of like-minded souls who want to have a laugh and form a community.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the first afternoon Sunday Assembly ever!
Yay! Saunderson Jones, who, believe me, looks exactly how you'd imagine Jesus would do if he was living in London in 2013 and had a penchant for hipster knitwear, and his very funny Mary Magdalene, a.k.a. Pippa Evans, lead the service in the dilapidated, deconsecrated church in North London.
Yes, so we have each one of these Sunday assemblies has got a theme. The theme for this one is Linda Hennett.
The theme of today's assembly is helping, and a former vicar is brought in to tell us about his charity, which helps disadvantaged kids get into university.
Our producer said that, unfortunately, she was going to have to quit because she saw everyone in a church enjoying themselves so much that and celebrating their own beliefs that it helped her rediscover her Christianity.
We're all squeezed onto a mixture of church pews, wooden chairs and benches. Those sitting around me tell me why they decided to come.
We're getting to an age where we kind of the effects of alcohol are a bit too much. So we're kind of toning it down now. And we're getting up early on Sundays and we're not religious. And we just saw the advert for this and thought, oh, it's going to be quite interesting.
Have you ever, like, attended church or any kind of sort of group before?
No, not since I was a kid.
I just came out of total curiosity, because I don't have a religion at all, and I don't believe in it. So many people are very lonely. I mean, 11 million people or something live on their own in this country, and loneliness is, as you know, is worse than smoking for people's well-being, then I should say, whatever. So it's very important that things like these are created. Very important.
I understand the organisers are atheists, but it didn't say that agnostics were prohibited or something, so I'm not an atheist, so I'll come along and they're not going to chuck me out. So
I think religion takes your brain away, really. It's sort of very much brainwashing. Yeah.
The Assembly definitely doesn't take itself too seriously, and Pippa brilliantly satirises the reasons some people start helping, laughing at herself in the process, while simultaneously making it a cool thing to do. After the ceremony, I catch up with her and ask her why start a godless gathering.
For me, I went to church till I was 17, and then I stopped believing in God. And the thing I missed wasn't God, but church. So for me, it was, how can you have that experience without? So it's quite nice that you can have like-minded people, and we don't really ask people what they believe here. You know, you can come whatever you think, but what we say is that that's not important here, if you like.
Sanderson Jones bounces up, and I wonder if he has any messiah tendencies since he started to gather a bit of a following.
No, I think that all of my friends say they're just going to go, hey, remember, no matter how good this goes, you're still an idiot. So, I think I've got that won't happen.
But why a church, then, if there's no God involved?
Well, I did actually always want it to be in an old church. That was the dream thing. We were looking at other places, but, you know, why is it that people who are atheists get married in a church? But there is something about this building. It's a traditional building where people in Britain have gone for 1,400 years, and it's a sort of place where I think there's a concept of the numinous, the sort of place where your heart can rise up to the higher things, which inspires those thoughts. And there's something about a bit of continuity which enables people to make a transition to something which is new.
Having belted out three great songs and listened to some inspiring talks, I have a sense of well-being. My fellow attendees seem to feel the same.
It was very entertaining and very funny.
It has the real message of what religion should be about, helping each other. I think it gives you that positiveness about life.
I'm actually a Christian, so I came here before my real church service. So I'm going to go to church now, like Anglican church. And I really like it. It's fun and it's very well intentioned. I really like it.
But I can't help wondering, for all the great intentions, at the power that people like this potentially have in their hands. And as the Assembly prepares to go global and keeps growing, reaching Australia in April, is following any leader really a good idea? I haven't yet gone out to help anyone, but it definitely got me to wonder more, and ever since, I've had Bonnie Tyler on loop in my brain. Emma Wallace, DW, London.
I'm Neil King in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. Thank you. You're listening to Inside Europe. I'm Neil King in Bonn. Coming up in the next half hour, we'll be looking into European demographics and why some countries just can't get their birth rates up.
So the problem has become more severe over the years. The way we'll build a species is to stop having children when you're 30, not to start having children when you're 30. I mean, it's very important that we communicate that this has a price.
Also on the programme, we'll be hearing how Welsh hill farmers are coping after being hit by the worst winter storm in decades, right at the height of the lambing season. And you'd better stay tuned if you fancy yourself as a bit of Casanova. We'll be taking you to a seduction school, French style. It's no secret that some European countries are sitting on a demographic time bomb. Declining birth rates plus an ageing population spell trouble for any society in the long run. Take the pension system, for instance, which relies on a good balance of young and old to survive. So what needs to be done? European population experts say achieving gender equality, including men and women sharing the burden of child-raising, is the secret to increasing the birth rate. They cite an increase in birth rates in Sweden and persistently low birth rates in more sexist societies as proof. Kerry Skyring reports from Vienna.
Today, Christina and Thomas are at home with their two girls, Hannah and Alexandra. Both parents have busy jobs too. This may seem like an average Austrian family, but it's not. The national birth rate averages out at 1.4 per woman, making a two-child family something of a novelty. Christina, an architect, says Thomas does his share of the housework, which is how they make things work.
Because he's a houseman, something like this, and my job is I'm architect, and therefore my job is sometimes I have nothing to do and sometimes it's many things to do.
The long-term trend for Austria's birth rate, like Germany's, is downwards, despite increased government spending on family support, including paid maternity leave. But a few countries which spend a similar amount to Germany on maternity and childcare policies, like Sweden and France, are reversing the trend. Vitalia Gaketovitic heads the population unit at the United Nations Economic Commission for Europe. She says it's gender equality which makes the difference.
There is quite a substantive evidence that the more recent trend is of fertility increasing in the so-called postmodernist countries, in the North European countries mainly, where the gender equality, or rather gender balance, is about to happen or already happening. Not only from the laws, but also in the mentality of people.
Thomas, an electrical engineer, is cooking the evening meal. He admits he's probably not your average Austrian male.
I think this is not a typical way in Austria, because normally the wife is cooking and has to do some dishwashing and laundry and everything. So,
is it 50% of the household work for you and 50% for Christina?
Well, we don't actually have an exact number, but I think, yes, it should be okay, because Christina is bringing the kids to school, I go shopping for the food, and maybe this is kind of a halbe-halbe.
Things are clearly working for Thomas and Christina, but conservative politicians often claim that more women in the workforce keeps the birth rate down in wealthy Western societies. Vitalia says the evidence suggests otherwise.
Perceptions of the traditional society, which is still prevails in Germany, and in comparison with Sweden, where it changed that attitude. And spending for the family support nearly the same amount and putting clause into nearly in the same way, the result in Sweden is much better. The fertility now is about 1.9 child per woman, while in Germany it doesn't work.
Christina says job security and an understanding boss were big factors in her decision to have children, along with a husband who shares the workload.
Because in Austria there are many people who say the man has to do his work and he can't do less hours in the job, and the women have to do the family. And so it's for many women not possible to have children.
Austria and Germany spend a lot of money rewarding parents. In Austria, it's €105 per child per month, increasing to over €150 as the years go on. It's paid until the offspring start work, or until they're 25 years old, whichever happens first. Germany is even more generous. Wolfgang Lutz, demographer at the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis, says too often population policies are driven by populism.
There is yet another dimension that comes through in many of the statements by politicians who say that the demographic decline is a national security crisis or whatever. That is sort of a nationalistic thinking, that you want to see more of some kind of people and fewer of another kind of people. And that's, of course, a discussion that we had for decades and centuries in Europe. And I think we are slowly overcoming is to put less emphasis on this nationalistic perspective.
But what about all of those family benefits, like Austria's direct payments for having children? Are they useful?
They may produce improvements for families with young children, and that is desirable in its own end, because in our modern societies, really, families with children tend to be underprivileged.
Thomas gives Hannah her piano lesson. Christina, who was late home from work, sits down to her evening meal, cooked by Thomas.
Sometimes I do more and then he has to take more of the job because I'm not here and have many things to do.
Austria once debated writing laws that would require men to take on at least 50% of housework and child-raising duties. It didn't happen. Based on the research coming out of Northern Europe, it might be time to restart the debate. Kerry Skyring, DW, Vienna.
Well, Sweden might be full of bouncing babies, but just next door, Denmark is one of the European states faced with a demographic challenge. The country's birth rate fell again last year to 1.7 births per couple. Denmark's experts are warning the problem looks set to become worse, creating more challenges for the country. Wakas Chuktai has the details from Copenhagen.
In rows of twos, dressed in snowsuits, hats and boots, a dozen preschool-aged children walk along the sidewalk hand in hand. For years now, the number of children in this age group has been slowly decreasing. The main reason? Many couples are delaying starting a family.
I thought about that while I was taking my education, I thought about, okay, I want to wait until I'm finished, but it wasn't planned.
Christina had her first and only son when she was 27. She's now in her early 30s and says she wants another child, but isn't sure when.
Now I just want to wait until I think it's the right time.
But doctors say some couples may be waiting too long, and that right time is slipping away.
30 years ago, the average age was 24, 25 for a woman when she had her first child. Now it's close to 30.
Søren Zeeb is head of the fertility clinic at Copenhagen's main hospital, Rigshospital.
And that means that when you have your first child at that age, the likelihood of you having another or third child is much lower now than it was previously. So the problem has become more severe over the years. And I mean, the way we'll build a species is to stop having children when you're 30, not to start having children when you're 30. I mean, it's very important that we communicate that this has a price.
The price, Zeeb says, is that more and more young couples are turning to fertility clinics for help. In fact, about one out of every 10th child is now born through in vitro fertilization. Part of the reason is because the sperm quality in Danish men is going down. Right now, about 25% have a low sperm count. Doctors don't know the reason for this, but Zeeb says it might be because of exposure to different chemicals.
We have different issues suggesting that we might be affecting our underlying biology in this, so that our ability to have children is affected over time. And we need to address this. We need to talk about this. What is the reason for all this?
Zeeb says it's also important to discuss the economic consequences. A low birth rate quite simply means a shrinking population. Demographer Hans Olav Hansen has looked at the numbers. He predicts the number of children will decrease by around 200,000 by 2045, while the number of seniors will increase by about the same amount.
And it means one more thing, a diminishing labor supply. The labor force will go down and it will become older.
Hansen predicts the number of people able to work will fall by 650,000. For Denmark, a country with a current population of about 5.5 million, that could pose a serious challenge. The government relies on the working class to pay high taxes in order to fund social welfare programs. And so, the country is looking for solutions.
In the Lego butique.
Sophie Anderson talks to her 4-year-old son about his Lego toy. Usually, her focus is on how to help other couples have children. She is a member of parliament and health spokesperson for the ruling Social Democrats. She also chairs the all-party group on sexual and reproductive health.
What we are discussing is, have we gone too far in telling the kids how to avoid an unwanted pregnancy, or should we also give some advice to young people around the 20s about, you know, how to keep being fertile, how to what decisions to make in order to be able to get children in the future?
But some experts, including Hansen, think all the government can do is talk and very little to actually increase the birth rate. Denmark already has many social programs to help new parents, like year-long parental leave and subsidized nurseries. Instead, Hansen says the solution should include highly selective immigration. But that's a controversial idea. Some fear it would threaten Denmark's identity as a homogeneous state. Anderson doesn't think it can be a standalone option.
I think it is poses a challenge to how to get a positive immigration if you don't have a younger base of Danes that are born and raised here in the country with that culture. And so I don't mind immigration, but it's very difficult to make it work in real life.
To begin with, I think we quite naively just opened our gates to...
Finn Andersen is the Secretary General of the Danish Cultural Institute. He isn't against immigration and doesn't believe it will threaten Danish culture. But he adds the country needs to integrate newcomers.
If you come from a culture and a foreign place where you speak a completely different language and you don't start learning Danish when you come into the country, you're obviously not very successful on the labour market. You have very limited opportunities.
But rather than opening its doors, in recent years, Denmark has tightened its immigration laws, for instance, making it harder for family reunification or to bring in a foreign spouse. So for now, it seems all Denmark is left with is fewer children and even fewer solutions. Vikas Chukthai, DW, Copenhagen.
Well, falling birth rates are not really an issue when it comes to sheep. But this year's lambing season in Wales has been severely disrupted by one of the worst snowstorms in over 50 years. Over the past 10 days, hill farmers have been digging up the carcasses of thousands of heavily pregnant ewes and newborn lambs buried under blankets of snow. Earlier, I spoke to Emia Jones, the president of the Farmers' Union of Wales, who's just returned from the stricken region. He told me more about the situation on the ground and how the farmers are coping.
This is the worst weather I have seen at the end of March, beginning of April. I've never seen it so bad. There are still sheep buried under these snowdrifts, and we will not know really the impact and the final total number of sheep and lambs that have died until the snow melts away, and that could be in a week or so again.
So what does this mean for the sheep farmers in Wales? How many do you expect to actually be out of business after this crisis is over?
Well, it'll affect quite a few sheep farmers, obviously, because the margins are not there. We've heard the statistics, what the profit is for last year, you know, and the average is below £10,000 per farm. And, you know, losing a couple hundred sheep, you know, that's a huge loss for for all farmers to lose animals. And what we are looking for is that the Minister, Alan Davies, and the Welsh Government will introduce an emergency aid package to help farmers, the knackleries, you know, the people who carry these dead animals away from farms. They are so busy that they will not be able to cope with all the work. And we are asking the Minister if he would allow us all to bury our dead animals like we did years ago, before this daft rule came from Europe that prohibited us to bury our dead animals on our own farm. And that would be the cheapest option for everybody.
Okay, so it's also, I assume it's hygienic concerns that these regulations stipulate that sheep should not be buried on site, but it would alleviate the situation for farmers right now.
Yes. It would be a huge help if we all were allowed to bury our dead animals.
What do you think could be done to avoid a repeat of this crisis next year, or to at least reduce the risk that there might be a repeat like this?
Well, it's very difficult to predict, isn't it, really, how bad the weather can be. And on hill farms, the majority do not have any in-by land. They don't have any sheds to put these ewes in. So they depend, really, on the ewes, the Welsh mountain ewe, making sure that she finds enough shelter. And usually she will do that because it's a breed that will fend for themselves and live on the mountain. But when you get real bad weather, as we had in the last 10 days, you know, and snow drifts up to 20 foot high, there's nothing really you can do. A freak storm like this only happens hopefully once every 50 years, and hopefully we won't see another one for another 50 years, but who knows?
That was Emyr Jones, the president of the Farmers Union of Wales. And I'm Neil King in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. Turkish men living in Germany don't have many places to go to discuss their problems. But one self-help group in Berlin aims to change this by giving them a place to talk about family drama, work issues, and even their sexual orientation. Michael Scaturo reports.
About 40 Turkish men begin taking their seats in a street-level office in Berlin's Neukölln neighborhood. One person hands out tea and biscuits. Kazim Erdogan, a grandfatherly man at the head of the room, kicks off the meeting. By day, Erdogan works as a psychologist in the city's child welfare system. But every Monday evening at 6 p.m., he opens his men's group meeting in Turkish. And he says there's a simple reason for this.
60-70% of the men don't speak German fluently, so we hold the meetings in Turkish.
Erdogan's group is called Aufbruch Neukölln. Founded in 2007, it initially aimed to help Turkish men be better fathers. But the group has since grown into an informal support network for Turks in Berlin. Erdogan invites quarreling fathers and sons or bickering husbands and wives to the group to help them solve their disputes. More serious discussions take place in his office at the city's child welfare office.
If someone doesn't feel comfortable talking in front of the group, he can see me privately.
But many men do open up in the group sessions. Towards the back of the room sits a 32-year-old former paramedic. The second-generation Turkish-German declines to give his name, but he says he's just gone to jail for beating his girlfriend and that he wants to turn his life around.
I take part in the group to work on myself, to see what went wrong with my life.
One of the group's most active members is Murat Tash. The 40-year-old has helped organize anti-domestic violence marches with Kasım Erdoğan.
I know a man, he has 4 kids. He was beating his wife, leaving her with injuries on her body. At some point, he left the family for half a year. But Kasım Erdoğan helped the man to understand that what he was doing was wrong. He realized that violence wasn't the answer, that people need to talk through their problems, and now he's happy.
That man didn't come the night that I attended. And hearing his story actually made me a little uncomfortable. Doesn't Kasım Erdoğan have a responsibility to call the police when he learns of such spousal abuse? Erdoğan says he doesn't.
If I call the police, then I've abused the participants' trust. Then they'll stop coming. If I call the police even once, word will get around. And then I'm a traitor. My feeling is that the best way to prevent a problem is to talk to the people, to take them seriously, and to win their trust.
Erdoğan underscores his belief in privacy by telling me about gay Turkish men who were stuck in arranged marriages.
I've spoken with fathers who were married but gay. They had kids. After 10, 15 years, they came out, moved in with their partners. They don't want to talk about it publicly. Some haven't even told their families. But with me, in this room, they open up. 5 men have come out to me. They were Turkish men who were married, lived with their wives, were homosexual, but decided, I'm gay, and came out.
Erdoğan says teaching Turkish men and boys to talk out their problems not only reduces violence, but also helps immigrants fit in better in their adoptive countries. He plans to expand the program to immigrant communities in other German cities, and possibly even in other EU capitals with large Arab and Turkish populations in the coming months. Michael Scutoro, DW, Berlin.
Now, the French have always had a bit of a reputation when it comes to wooing the opposite sex. At least, that's the stereotype. But what if the French are actually losing their seductive touch? Well, if the proliferation of books, DVDs and coaching sessions are anything to go by, many feel they need help. Our reporter in Paris, John Laurenson, has been brushing up the basics at a Parisian seduction school.
Voilà, donc effectivement, quand il y a une bonne rencontre dans la rue et un bon échange et qu'après la fille reçoit ça,
Seduction coach Alex Roth tells a classroom of note-taking students a cautionary tale about the importance of correct spelling when texting women. 25 years old, tall and thin, carefully stubbly and elegantly dressed, he exudes the quiet self-confidence they dream of acquiring. But he says he didn't used to be like this.
The old story is about how to be better as a man, because when I was younger, as a teenage, I was kind of obese, you know, and I was kind of lonely, not so many friends, so I wonder how to make some friends. So I searched on the internet, I read some books, and one day I said, okay, as a challenge to myself, I said, I have to lose some weight, I have to go out and to meet some people, to make some friends, to have a girlfriend. So it was quite a hard job, but now I can help other men to do the same, because I did the job before.
Alex now runs one of a number of companies whose aim is to enhance the seductive power of French men. At his 1,000 euro study weeks, he teaches students to dress like men, not boys, as he puts it, to approach women in the street from the front. From behind is scary, to smile and keep smiling. Don't tell her she's beautiful, that's what they all say. Best to compliment her on something she's chosen, a piece of clothing, her bag. But, says ex-student Vincent, the key is learning to improvise.
When you want to meet different girls in the street, you have to look and see what you can say to her that is different than every other guy's.
Can you remember any successful pickup lines that you used?
Yeah, I met a girl, she was waiting for someone, yeah. And I told her, I'm sorry, I'm late. So it's funny. It's funny. And it did work.
And after the theoretical classes, the practical. A sunny afternoon outside the Pompidou Centre Art Museum. Nicolas breaks into a run. He and his coach have spied a target, sparkly T-shirt, at 2 o'clock.
Excuse-moi.
Excuse me, I've just seen you, and I think that with that T-shirt with sequins on, you must be a gold digger or something. Your style is really not bad.
Thank you, that's kind.
In fact, I would love to talk to you. I really like your little smile as well. Unfortunately, I have to meet some friends, but if you like, you and me, we can exchange phone numbers.
Oh, that's kind, but I have a lover.
Listening in thanks to a discreet microphone clipped to Nicolas' shirt, Alex shrugs. Rejection is okay, he says, part of a useful toughening up process.
In our society, we are truly overprotected. Yeah, by our parents, by the society. A lot of clients are afraid of approaching women. And we can't bear the fact of being rejected or test new things in your life, take some risks, and that's the problem.
But things used to be different. You shouldn't read with the book so close to your face. You've got very, very pretty eyes. It'll damage them. Flirting in the Luxembourg Gardens in the 1959 film Charlotte et Véronique. From the movies of the Nouvelle Vague to books and plays like Dangerous Liaisons and Molière's Don Juan, seduction has long been part of French culture. But is it still true of the French today? Down in the Luxembourg Garden, I ask some present-day Charlotte and Véroniques to describe the best and the worst attempts to chat them up.
She said, "Hey, do you hear the news? Biarritz won."
The rugby team.
Yeah, rugby team. And was very happy, I remember her face. Big smile, you know. Yeah. And I say, "Oh, great, great news." So I say, "Yeah, do you want to drink? You want to celebrate this because... he's from Biarritz." And I say, "Yeah, why not?"
We were in on a boat. There was a club on a boat. And we just arrived. And a guy came and say, "Oh, you dance so well." And we're like, "We just arrived. I mean, come on, you couldn't see us dancing or anything." So,
yeah. That's nice. was that a bad experience or a good experience?
No, it's bad experience because it would say that to any girl.
Any good experiences?
Yeah, I was just walking in the street, and I looked on a shop. Like, I was putting my hands like this because I couldn't see well. And so there was a guy in the shop, and so he tried to get my attention. So then I laughed, and then he came out of the shop, and we talked, and yeah, that was fun.
Back outside the Pompidou Centre, seduction student Nicolas is not having much fun at all. How many girls has he approached this afternoon? Everybody's lost count.
Excusez-moi. Je viens de te voir et franchement, je te trouve plutôt pas mal comme fille.
Ah bon, pas mal.
Ouais.
Possibly suffering from charm fatigue, he opens with, "Excuse me, I think you're not bad looking." To which the young lady replies, "Oh yeah, how many out of 10?" But despite inauspicious beginnings,
si tu veux, toi et moi, on peut échanger nos coordonnées.
Sans problème.
When he asks for her number, she replies, "No problem." And when he comes back to receive the congratulations of his coach, his smile, perhaps for the first time this afternoon, is a real one.
Comment tu t'appelles?
Nicolas.
John Lawrenson, DW, Paris.
Alors, 06.
41.
68.
And that just about wraps up today's show. If you want to drop us a line, we're always very happy to hear your thoughts on the show. Our email address is europe@dw.de, or send us a letter to Inside Europe, Deutsche Welle Radio, Bonn, Germany. We hope you enjoyed the programme and will join us again next week. On behalf of producer Emma Wallace and sound engineer Jürgen Kuhn, thanks for listening, and it's goodbye from me, Neil King. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn.